And we are live. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Cannabis Insider. I'm Pato Little, joined by my fantastic co-host, Nico Rodriguez. And we are really thrilled to have you with us today for a special edition of Cannabis Insider. Thanks to our partners, we are kicking off our first ever B2B webinar series dedicated to the cannabis industry.
That's right, Pato. Hello, everyone. Today we have a special guest. Whether you're a cultivator, you're in distribution, you're in retail, you're looking to expand or buy or access to more market cap, whatever you're looking for in terms of finance, today's the day.
That's right. And I think it's very important to know that this isn't just another Benzinga event. Here at Benzinga, we're truly on tour, I can say, with our coverage on the federal and state cannabis markets. We have our spotlights for state-specific cannabis events and investing more resources in the sector than anyone else. So today's webinar is a part of that larger journey, bringing more to you after hosting some of the biggest and most impactful cannabis events in the industry.
That's right, Pato. We're doubling down. You know, huge country, a lot to cover. You know, we have consolidated markets, emerging markets. We have the needs of entrepreneurs, cultivators, huge industry, very extends, is still in development, supply chain, and a lot of different needs and opportunities out there. So you want to tell us who are joining us today, who are the experts?
Of course, sir. We have a huge panel today of experts in cannabis financing. We have Adam Stettner of FunCanna, a pioneer in providing tailored financial solutions in the cannabis industry, who will share his insights on access to capital and liquidity challenges. Also, we will be talking with Seth Yakatan of Caden Associates International, who is known for his experience in connecting operators with vital capital, and will help us demystify cannabis investments. And finally, we will have also Henry Miller from Polaris Capital Group, a specialist in real estate financing within the cannabis space, who will discuss the impact of regulatory changes on financial strategies.
Let's get ready. A lot to unpack there. This is our first B2B series of events, and we're talking to a large audience of people interested in how to access capital, what's the right type of capital, how to make use of this capital. So let's get ready to unpack. Let's bring it on board. Hello, Adam, Seth, and Henry. Welcome to Cannabis Insider. Today, we're how are you today? Let's hear from you. Are you having a good time?
Absolutely. Doing well. Thanks for having us.
Always.
We're very happy to have you here today.
Fantastic. Like we said, first B2B series of events of this cannabis media. We're touring 24/7 in all states. And today we're here today to talk a little bit about what we described the other day as the entourage effect of cannabis financing, because we have so many tools in the box to use at different times, you know, whether you're at a growing stage or you're trying to expand your capacity in the cannabis business, whether you're looking for revolving debt or you're looking for to grow your real estate business or to connect some of these service providers. You know, all cannabis businesses need a physical space, right? But none of us or not many of us paying cash. So, you know, I'm just looking at some of the basic questions that real businesses have in this industry. And today we have a distinguished panel. And I want to sort of like to start, start a little bit about discussing the different tools in the box. You know, I want to touch on some other issues like what's the role of microcaps and what should companies be looking at. But let's get started by talking a little bit about discussing the instruments, right? The tools that we have. And talk a little bit about, you know, angel capital, debt, asset-backed financing, loans. I want to hear from you, Adam. Let's go ahead and we'll turn on to the rest of the experts for today. Thank you very much.
Sure. So you named a bunch. Those are all available to the space. They're not easy to come by, but they are all available. I think equity and debt are the primary drivers of funding, and they both have their place. So although FundCanna is the equivalent of a debt provider, I'm a strong believer in equity. I will tell you that equity is an amazing tool, but in cannabis in particular, I think in all industries, but cannabis in particular, it has to be strategic. Equity is the most expensive money you can get in the sense that you're giving a piece of your business away that you cannot get back. And so for that reason, I think it's very important that you not only know intimately who you're bringing on as your partner, but that they bring value beyond the money. And then and equity is great, especially early in the stage of starting a business up. Debt is not feasible because you don't know what you can service, and your repayment timelines are very difficult. So early stage businesses should be raising equity. Again, not easy to come by, but nonetheless, it makes sense. And then debt should be used to fuel growth from there, or purchase either hard assets, inventory, equipment, etc., because you're able to create leverage. So equity and debt both have their place, but I think very important that strategy is deployed, especially on the equity side.
We're going to get there. We're going to get to the strategy side. Seth, I want to hear your take too on what are your, let's say, your favorites.
Listen, I think it doesn't matter what my favorite is, and it doesn't matter what the right corporate finance solution is. I'm more of a street guy, so in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And what I mean by that, in most capital market situations that I've been in either early stage biotech or in cannabis, there's not a lot of money available. So sometimes for me, it comes down to, can you get your company funded? Period. And in a lot of instances, specifically with where we're at in this cycle in cannabis, there ain't any equity, right? The Canadian capital markets opened up in a window very early on, from kind of call it 12 to 16. That window very precipitously closed. If you didn't get out in that window, you probably weren't going to get out there. A lot of the equity funds that have raised money in that period of time didn't get a return, so they weren't able to go raise a second fund, so they don't have any money. So I think when I kind of look at the corporate finance solution that's right in cannabis, I tend to kind of focus more on the fact of, can you raise money or not, and look at the structure of it as secondarily. And unfortunately, no matter what capital structure you're going to go after in cannabis today, whether it's debt or equity that performs like that, it's probably going to be expensive, and it's probably going to be 2 to 6 times more expensive than the cost of capital for any other industry that I've seen. So,
wow.
Thank you, Seth. Henry, maybe we can build on Seth's point, which is that, you know, the good capital is the capital that you can find. And think about, you know, what are the instruments that you think apply best for different stages, whether it's the supply chain or whether it's a seed company or a more established company. Can you recommend any of these instruments? So, like, you know, get the ball rolling.
Sure thing. I think there's elements that both my colleagues here touched on that are important. There's an element that you need to take the capital available, because if you don't, your competitors might. But then there's also an optimal capital structure where if you take on the wrong type of financing, it may work in the short term, but long term doesn't set your business up for success. And it's important to balance those two things. Our group, Polaris Capital Group, we're a dedicated real estate lender. One of the values to using debt on your real estate is that cannabis can be a high capex industry, especially on the production side. So the ability to effectively utilize debt means that the equity capital that you might have raised can be used elsewhere in the business and is not tied up in that hard asset, or at least not 100% tied up in that hard asset. So effectively being able to use both is great for operators.
Thank you for that.
Go ahead, Toto. Because I was thinking, you know, I went ahead, you know, because I was hooked on this. I was thinking, you know, we talked about the instruments a little bit at glance to have sort of like a perspective. But then, Adam, I wanted to go back to you and ask you about in terms of what are the, you know, we talk about one end, sort of like where you go to and what's your objective as a company. But then within the company, within the firm, what are sort of like the aspects that it's important to keep in line or to that are going to sort of like provide a capacity to acquire a loans or to apply for these solutions to work with you guys? What should companies on the other end, people, folks who are looking at this, should be aware of or thinking about concentrating on within their organization?
Well, I think use is number one. And I say this less as Funcana and more as somebody that leverages both equity and debt myself. How are you going to use the money is where every operator should start. And let's start there. We're talking here about the lack of accessibility, the cost of money. But if you can do more with the money than the cost, the money is not expensive. And I say that I realize the comment is controversial, but let's really think for a minute. If somebody borrows X amount of dollars and they can make more than X on the repayment, the delta between what that money costs them and the repayment of that money is margin that they otherwise would not have. So I think first, every operator, every person listening to this really needs to think about accessibility of money, how they're going to use that capital, what they think they will make on that money, and then compare the cost of capital to what their intended use is and what they believe their revenue, their margin, their creation will be beyond that. That spread is profit that they wouldn't otherwise have. If they can't do that simple exercise, and I'm not saying this in a condescending, oversimplified way, I'm just giving the basic. When you ask what should someone think about, I think that's where they start. And if you can't come up with a way to deploy that money and make money beyond the cost of capital, then the money is expensive. But if you do, especially if you're already operating, then leverage is key to operating any business in any industry, cannabis in particular, because to answer your question, Nico, directly, this industry is one where it's either COD, right, cash on delivery, or you have terms. And those terms never match the revenue cycle. So no matter what, you're out of pocket or you've got dead money for a period, which means you're locked, you're frozen, and you can't create that elasticity of cash out while you're waiting for cash in. It's very hard to grow if you're locked in that cycle. So then going back to what you asked for, what we're looking at, we're looking for operating businesses because I am not on the equity side. And in order for me to make sure I'm a good partner to our clients, we need to make sure we're not over leveraging them. And the way we do that is to take a look at inflow and outflow of money. We look at bank statements. We look at average balances. I am less concerned with the true gap accounting of profitability than I am the inflow and outflow of money and the ability to service the debt, because ultimately I want to be a long-term partner where Funcana is leveraged almost like revolving facility. Use us when you need us, pay us back when you don't, draw again, draw three times in a row, however the money is needed, but always make sure that when you're drawing, the cost of that capital is below the revenue that you're going to create from the draw. So the concept that Seth mentioned about access to capital is good, right? And any money you can get in this environment is good. I agree. But what I would say from my perspective, I never want someone to view me nor Funcana as having burdened their business. And so to that end, I want to make sure that if they're going to borrow, and we assist with that as part of the underwriting, that if they're going to borrow, that they have the ability to pay it back with room so that we're not squeezing. And I think it's very important that when you're looking at debt in particular, you as an operator, look at it through that lens.
Thank you very much. Very clear. Seth, I don't want you to fall asleep. So let's go to you. And I want to hear some of that street knowledge, wisdom. And what are your advice to folks who are in the, let's say, in the seed process or are looking for capital? They want to buy some working machines or whatever they want to do. What's your advice?
I'm going to break a lot of hearts with what I'm going to say. There are probably 12 or 15 business models in cannabis. Some of them overlap, like with an MSO, they might have 7 of them. And, you know, it's pretty clear to me that there's several business models that just don't make money, right? So if we look at the business-to-business distribution model that has been legislated into California, Nabis has been successful at it, but it's extremely difficult to make money in that business, right? To make real money. So the first thing that I kind of look at is, you know, if there's 15 models, are you in one of these models that's never going to make money? Well, then it's going to be exceptionally hard for you to raise money, and I'm probably not that interested in helping. Okay. So the first thing is, can you drive profit? And it's very clear to me that there's several models in cannabis where it's where profit is extremely constrained. Right? The second thing that I'm going to tell you is that early stage stuff is nearly impossible. If someone comes to me with another idea for, you know, an asset light brand in a highly penetrated state like California, or if someone has a license for a dispensary in a highly penetrated state like California or Oklahoma, and it hasn't been built out and you've never done it before, you're a unicorn. You're trying to become a movie star. And the probability of you raising that capital outside of friends, families, and angels, and even if you can, it's just going to be really, really, really hard. So, you know, I think the dose of reality that you have to kind of have is if you're looking at yourself in the mirror as a CEO and you're in one of these models that never is going to be profitable, you can out hustle me and you can outwork me and you can out connect anybody. It's just going to be hard. And if you're, you know, in an early stage model, I think it's going to be hard. For my money and for my time where I've had the most success and, you know, it's not a lovely entrepreneurial story, but as people who have proven their model, who are generating revenue and are either break even or generating cash flow and are looking for that slug of growth capital that they need to get to the next state. I'm in 4 states. I want to get into 2 states. I have this much customer acquisition. I need more, you know, working capital and inventory to get more. I have 7 stores in California. I want to go to 10. That's the zone where you have, I think, financeability. And I think the key that people probably don't want to hear is that there's just many businesses that aren't fundable. I'll leave with one note, okay? We've all met a person in our life who has severe bad breath. Some of these companies, and I'm the kind of person that I'm going to say to you know you have bad breath, right? If nobody's ever told you, I'm going to tell you. And it's that same kind of tough love that you need to give to some of the people in the industry that you're just pushing a rock up a hill and it's going to roll back down. So that's my thought.
Absolutely. Now that's a great analogy. And I think it brings us to a great spot for our next question, which is basically risk management. We know this is a volatile market and basically managing risk is crucial for us to be able to anticipate when we cannot just smell the bad breath of someone. So maybe to start with, Henry, drawing from your experience in real estate, can you discuss the risk assessment and maybe mitigation approaches when dealing with cannabis-related investments?
Absolutely, and it's a great counterpoint opportunity, I think, to something Seth just said. I actually agree with everything you said, Seth, but one thing that I would add is when you're assessing the risk of your business or as an investor, looking at the market that you're in. I agree, an early stage business in California today is going to be a lot more challenged than an early stage business that just passed legislation in a limited license market. The second phase of that risk assessment is, if you are that early stage operator in a new market, you have everything today, but don't assume that that market will be the same forever. So Polaris, we're very data focused, and we've taken a keen approach to tracking each market cycle. One of the ways that we assess risk is to track what's online or coming online in each individual state. Because the reality is, in another industry, if you start a business, you're a U.S. company. And while cannabis companies are U.S. companies, they are very state specific to their market. So you may have a business that generates $4,000 a pound today, but you should be underwriting your business to what it might be doing 2 years from now and making sure that you are still positive cash flow at that point.
Absolutely. Adam, do you have any take on this?
In terms of risk management?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So look, I think everything that Seth and Henry said accurate. You think, look, we have funded businesses in 41 states. We've underwritten 2,700 prospective clients. And funded about 1,500, actually closer to 1,700 now, of them. And so when we look across the landscape of states, there is clear delineation by state, by concentration, by vertical. It's not just geography. Time in business makes a difference. Amount of revenue, gross top line revenue, starts to become an indicator. So where you are and what you intend to do, not to parrot what Seth and Henry have said, those things really do matter. Now, from my perspective, when we're assessing risk internally, we're, as I said earlier, we're looking at inflow and outflow of money and the ratios of that. We're looking at average daily bank balances. What's the liquidity on a regular basis? Because if we're going to fund a business, let's say I just pick an arbitrary number, for $250,000 on a revolver, we want to make sure that we're not funding into a business that had a negative $80,000 balance, right? It, all we're doing, we're not looking to pour gasoline on the wrong kind of fire. So for us, we're looking to make sure that they've been through a few cycles, that they understand the core business that they're operating, that their financials can support repayment without us being burdensome or getting ourselves into a situation that's untenable. And so the risk for me, I think, is geography, vertical, experience, and demonstration that they know how to operate a business. But what I'm going to say is, of those 2,700 to 3,000 or so businesses that we've looked at, our approval rate on new clients is north of 60%. Which tells you that's very high. And on repeat business, our approval rate is just shy of 90%. And blended, we're looking at roughly a 72% approval rate. That's unheard of in finance. It's incredibly high. Why? Because this industry is resilient and stronger than it appears on the surface. It's stronger than the headlines. And I don't want to overstate it, but I will say for existing revenue producing businesses only, because I do not count pre-revenue in those application and approval statistics. But for existing businesses, they have found ways to survive. They have found ways to continue to operate despite all these headwinds. So we're looking to mitigate our risk by reviewing financials, looking at where they are, what they do. And by that, I mean both geography and vertical, and looking at their financials. And from the client side, they should be doing their own model of risk mitigation in terms of who they get into bed with. And by that, I mean, it's easy to do your research on who you're about to borrow from. There are bad people on every corner. And so in all aspects of any industry. And so it's very important that you know who you're working with as a way to mitigate your own risk as a borrower. And it's also important, as I said earlier, to make sure you know how you're going to use that money and what you think the additional funding will do for your business. You should never borrow or drag equity in with the idea of it being a life preserver. That is not a good use of capital. So you want to mitigate that risk by just kind of like a simple pro and con checklist, use of funds, expectations, the most basic stuff. I'm not talking complicated pro forma, basics. So there are two sides to risk mitigation, both for the, in the case of putting money out, the funding source, but also the borrower should be doing their own set of research and assessment.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's a very interesting take, and we're getting a lot of insight from you. So I wanted to ask you a question, maybe on a side note, but I'm interested about technology and risk management. Is there any, I don't know, what role do you see technology playing in risk assessment and mitigation in cannabis investment, maybe now and also looking forward?
So can I jump in on that real quick?
Sure, yeah.
This is something we put a fair bit of effort in. So before cannabis, I was in consumer lending. And then after that, but also before cannabis, I was in commercial funding. And we used a fair bit of tech. But tech, as we all know, is evolving very quickly, especially with AI. Now, I'm not going to now start using a bunch of buzzwords and just drop AI. That's crazy, right? But what I will tell you is there are some incredible tools. So we use tools to validate licensing. We use tools to check on standing for Secretary of State registration. So for compliance, AML, anti-money laundering, KYC, know your customer. We're using tech for all of that. We're also using tech. We use instant bank verification. You'll hear people talk about IBV, companies like Plaid, for example. So we use IBV so that we can pull data into our system, and then our system automatically maps it, scrapes it, pushes the information to an underwriter so that we can move with speed and flexibility. Without technology, we move slowly. But what I can tell you, our average time from inception, I'm going back now 2.5 years, it takes us less than 24 hours to underwrite a client up to $1 million. And that's because of technology. But I'll go beyond that and say we're also integrating with a lot of sellers of product. Now, that could be, Seth mentioned a distributor. It can be with distributors. It can be with platforms that connect sellers of product to buyers of product, B2B only. But it can also be nutrients, lighting, et cetera, where we've embedded technology within those websites where we can instantly finance purchases, like the buy now, pay later products that you see in consumer. And again, without technology, that's not possible either. So we have instant approval technology on smaller transaction levels. And then we have under 1 day approval only because of technology on our traditional underwriting. But all of that technology goes into underwriting every client that we work with. And then, of course, we use Salesforce.com as our CRM. But within that, there's a whole universe of applications that are plugins for financial analysis and ratio building. And all of that is in play here, which, again, enables our underwriters to very quickly do assessments that would normally take days, not minutes.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And Seth, I know you're a more like a soft skill guy, connecting people with needs and with the means. So does technology play any role in your activity or do you leverage technology for your work also?
It does at some level. I use a lot of systems and qualitative research to be able to try and form assumptions on market. So, you know, I talk to people at BDSA and Hoodie and Headset, and I am deep into the qualitative research, the quantitative research that's provided by almost every major investment bank. I don't think there's one that I don't get the research from. And that usually gives me what I think is a summation of market. I also talk to a lot of desks. There's a group in, they were called Echelon Capital Markets. They changed their name. I don't know what they're called now. They got bought, but you know, they have a very active debt capital markets trading desk. And I like to check in with them about once a month to understand where things trade. I talk to a couple of the investment banks pretty regularly about what's happening on the equity in the private market. So I think I try to get a lot of knowledge about market, which isn't public. And usually that forms the basis of kind of the slope of the efficient line that I say is market. And once you've seen six or eight financings for, you know, a couple of different companies go down, you can kind of figure out where things should price. And that's usually how I try to, you know, leverage it. So
thank you very much.
The brain is still the most beautiful computer that has ever been created by anyone, whoever did create it. So until they phase me out and you're talking to my AI avatar, you're going to have to deal with me. So.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
But you might be talking to my AI avatar. So these aren't the droids that you're looking for.
Exactly. And Henry, I mean, we have talked here and been seeing and covered a lot of, well, not a lot, but some rate companies that usually leverage technology and geolocation for their business. So I also would like to hear your take also on this question. Sure. Again, technology and financing.
As a lender, and I touched on this a little earlier, we try to take a very data-focused approach to how we're underwriting new loans and new investments. On the macro side, that's accumulating and tracking in a proprietary model data across every state that has a legal program medically and recreationally, as well as pieces of Canada and elsewhere as sort of international markets start to open. And one of the things that allows us to do is look at where a market is in its life cycle. So if we are evaluating, say, an earlier stage business, is that a business that has room in the growth cycle of the market on a macro level, or is this a market that is starting to face compression and maybe there's a better allocation of capital elsewhere? And then on the operating side, to support existing operators, and this is something applicable to all operators, there's a number of data tools out there that we track, but some that are available to everyone to utilize that allow you to see at the retail level what are the leading brands and prices that they're selling for, as well as on the wholesale side, not just the quantity, but your sort of commoditized pricing over time. So if you're using tools like that as an operator, you can start to forecast, can I run my business profitably? And if I'm not competing, you know, what do I need to do as an operator to be the most competitive? And then on in-house, for example, we track the data over time there's a number of data points, but one example would be with cultivators, you're looking at their yields, right? How are they yielding compared to all other operators? And we can look at that and say to one portfolio company, hey, you're doing great. Here's some tweaks that you might make. Or we may look at a business that comes in the door. We can look at numbers and say, hey, this is either the best we've ever seen, or we know to ask some questions if it looks like something that might not be achievable. So I think the overarching theme there is data. And I think that's the future in a lot of technology, but that's how we use it. That's how I recommend operators use it.
Well, super interesting. And before we jump to the next question, which I think is going to be a hot one, I just wanted to mention that we are having a lot of questions in the chat. So thank you to all our audience that's here joining us. And again, we have some interesting questions that I would like to throw in once we finish with our questions, because I think they will add a lot of color at the end. So Nico, if you want to follow now.
Yeah. Let's keep an eye on the chat. There's some interesting questions, some good networking going on there. There a lot of email sharing. So look, we're already helping folks. So that's great. You know, I have a few questions, but just to follow up on the risk angle. The other day, I heard an executive say that the banking crisis for cannabis business is over. It has been over for years now, and I was wondering, what's your take on the, let's say, we talk about the instruments, we talk about what you do, we talk about the companies, what they need. Let's talk about the context, and let's talk a little bit about, you know, rescheduling, safe banking, What's the real impact of these two instruments? And also, what's the context? Is there a crisis, a banking crisis? Of course, there's a security problem, a public policy security issue, which in terms of, you know, a lot of cash-based operations, we know that, and it's a problem. But in terms of access to financing, is there such a crisis? I want to go, Seth. I want to hear from you first, and what's your take on this?
Well, you asked about three questions there, so I'll try to break it down. I don't think there's a crisis. I think over the last decade, the industry has created novel workarounds, but most federally chartered U.S. institutions do not want cannabis money. And I will tell everyone who's listening, if you are in the industry and you do not have a cannabis bank for your personal funds or for your corporate funds, go get one as a backup, because they're coming to throw you out of your institution eventually. It happened to me. They're coming. It's a matter of fact. They don't want your money. And the louder your presence is on LinkedIn, the more they're going to figure out that you're in the weed business. So take it from me. So I don't know that you have a crisis. You have, you know, I believe 5-6 national institutions, including, you know, East West Bank and First Citizens and Safe Harbor, and I'm probably leaving a couple out, Needham, you know, that are accepting deposits and are giving people solutions. So I don't know that you have a crisis. I'm not going to talk about politics. I do not know what's going to happen with Schedule 3 relative to whether it happens before the election or whether it happens after the election. I think cannabis should be federally legal. I will take 3 as a first step. I don't know that it solves a lot of things. I'll tell you what I do know, given that I am historically a pharmaceutical guy, I don't believe it creates the pharmaceuticalization of cannabis that some people think is coming, because the pharmaceutical business model is not to be in a CPG business. So I don't think that occurs. I don't know that 3 opens up SAFE. I hope it does. I don't really care if SAFE occurs. What I want to occur is the first company to list on NASDAQ as a plant touching company, because then it's game over. Then you're not going to be able to find me. You're going to have to come on my helicopter to find me on a super yacht, because so much money is going to show up in cannabis, and it's going to be so dumb that I'm just going to be like taking orders at that point. So whatever triggers that, I hope it's SAFE. But the minute that the first company lists on NASDAQ, it's going to more money is going to flow into this vertical than has ever flown into a vertical in the history of primates. Timestamp the video. I've said it 100 times. It's going to happen. I might be dead when it happens. They might kill me before it happens, but it's going to happen. And when that happens, it's game on.
Okay. Henry, I saw you smiling there with the NASDAQ nuke. What's your thoughts for that moment? Yeah.
I think we just saw about $1 trillion pump into GPUs in the last year. So I don't know if it'll be the biggest vertical ever, but I would agree with Seth that it will be a massive boon for cannabis capital markets. And I don't know that that's a Schedule 3. I do think that Schedule 3 is a benefit in that it makes it easier for research to get done. But as Seth probably knows a lot more about than I do, that research still takes time to even go from a place where you have products and then to even go from a Schedule 3 to considering descheduling altogether. So I think the bigger opportunity that we see is the elimination of 280E taxation. And I think everybody on this panel would agree. And it looks like we're very close to that. And the elimination of 280E not only makes the conditions a lot easier for operators, but it allows for more optimal capital structures on the balance sheet as well. But in cannabis, as long as I've been, these things have always been 6 months away, whether it's rescheduling or SAFE banking. So the thing that I always come back to is when you're modeling what you're doing in your business, whether it's a startup or operating, look at current conditions, and then the upside case should be if there's a reschedule. If the business doesn't work in current conditions, there should be a reevaluation.
Very clear. Adam?
Yeah, so on safe banking, I've said this before, I'll say it again. I forget the like fringe aspects of what they might wrap into safe banking. But if we just look at safe banking, I think it's total BS. It's a political football. It doesn't mean much. 2.5, 3 years ago, I'll go back actually even 4 years. 4 years when I started looking and really researching and studying this space, there were about 500 banks out of 15,000 that were servicing cannabis. That number is 850 now. Now, on a percentage basis, that's a lot of growth. 850 out of 15,000 is still only, you know, let's call it 7% or so. And so it's not much. But if you want to be banked in most states, you can be. Now, there are exceptions like Oregon where, you know, you may, banks are far away from where you're operating. But generally, if you want to be banked, you can be. Safe banking has made it 7 times for a vote, and it's never passed. Everybody uses it to grandstand. And by everybody, I mean politicians. They're all full of crap. So there I've said it. I don't think it will make much difference if or when it happens. Schedule 3, and I'm with Seth. I mean, we should just deschedule, not reschedule. But I'll take every ounce of momentum and progress we can get. Rescheduling to 3 would be amazing for the reason Henry gave. I agree. 280 is insane. It's a provision in the Internal Revenue Code that was designed specifically to bankrupt drug traffickers. And it applies now to businesses, tens of thousands of businesses that are operating legally in the states in which they operate by the letter of the law with licensing, and they're paying taxes. And it's absurd, and it gives them an effective tax rate, as everybody here knows, of roughly 70%. Why is it such a big deal? Make that go away. Every balance sheet looks better. Cash flow looks better. Right? Indebtedness, because everybody's on payment plans, looks better. What it enables them to do is use that free cash flow to hire, to grow business, to buy materials, et cetera, or more leverage because they have more free cash flow to service leverage. So I think it would be huge. I do also think that then you end up in a position where it's a little bit of a cluster again. You have the Cole memo that gave states power. Now, all of a sudden, if the Fed says, in essence, cannabis is a Schedule 3 drug, you have to rewrite Cole, or you have to do something, because states and Fed are still misaligned. And so I think it's a bit of a cluster, and it's really just being used by politicians to kind of advance their standing. And we should call it what it is. Having said that, like I said earlier, I will take whatever momentum we can get.
Thank you for that. Very clear, very honest. And maybe I was thinking, I mean, how might federal rescheduling impact international investments in the U.S. cannabis market? Is it possible that it has some impact, or you're thinking no, it's not?
Can you say that again? Sorry.
If you think that rescheduling will have any kind of impact on international investments in the U.S. cannabis market.
It's very hard to tell. I mean, in essence, the adult market would still be illicit, right? Mm-hmm. So you, if we go to schedule in the eyes of the Fed, if we go to right. Schedule 3, it now is treated like fentanyl, which is a prescription drug. It's very hard. I mean, it's a fair question, Pedro, but how might we know how investors from outside the country are going to look at this? Right. I don't know how investors inside the country are going to look at it, because the vast majority of cannabis sales are adult use, not medical, right? If we've got, you know, give or take, depending on where they are in states, but we've got give or take 40 states that are legal, but the vast majority of sales are occurring on the adult use side.
I think there's seams there. I think there's seams that appear, meaning that, you know, I view cannabis as just another CPG product that basically competes against alcohol, tobacco, broad CPG, non-alc bev,
luxury, wellness, and pharmaceutical. Okay, so it's growing at a faster rate than any of those other verticals. It has more consumer share of wallet and significantly less penetration. If you look it up, 80% of the products that you purchase are produced in some way, shape, or form by 20 companies on the planet. It's going to happen in cannabis. And I think what you've seen is kind of range finding shots that have been made by people. So if you look at the investment that British American Tobacco made into Organigram, which I think is one of the dumbest corporate uses of capital I've ever seen, British American Tobacco, please call me, you need help. That I think you're going to see continued range finding shots like that. And eventually, you know, someone's going to hit a target. Not that I want to talk about a specific company, but, you know, if you look at someone like Kiva and with how many states that they're in and their vertical distribution model and how well aspects of what they do fit into a large consumer product company, I think you're going to find somebody that reaches terminal velocity that either you see some of the strategic work that you saw come over early on in the industry, like the investment that Turning Point made into Old Pal. And I think you're going to start to see it leach into beverage. I believe right now beverage is a race to the first company who gets to $50 million in revenue, largely through Delta, and someone's going to buy the first three people that reach that vertical, that kind of level, and you're going to start to see some interesting things. So I think it's a matter of time. I don't know how it manifests, but I can, you know, see it coming. And I think that's probably one of the ways it comes.
Thank you, Seth. Go ahead, Nicholas.
Yeah, Seth. So I don't want to let this one go, Seth. I'm sorry. But without mentioning any specific companies, what do you think that, you know, characterized a bad deal in this case that you said it wasn't a good deal? Wait, why? If you can be, you know, brief about it, but I'm just interested because it might clarify a lot for you know, people who read the news on the issue, you know, and what's a good deal? But, you know, and we have plenty of questions. I want to get to some of the questions.
One of the things.
Yeah. I think he froze. Yeah.
Looks like let's wait. A second until Seth comes back. If not, we can jump to the next question.
Wow. Maybe he was hacked. No, I don't think so.
No. Okay, there you go.
My Wi-Fi went out. See, they're jamming. So my Wi-Fi went out. Sorry. Look, one of the things that we talked about earlier is how are you going to use your money? And one of the things for me that's a red flag, if you have a company that has traditionally distributed product through retail and they're raising $5 million to start a direct-to-consumer marketing business, that's a bad use of capital for me. Don't try and go do something you've never done. You're not Apple, right? You're Curaleaf. You're not Apple. Don't go start a DTC business. Average vertical, bad Fear. Use of capital. So when someone comes to me and says, what am I doing? The first thing is, what's a good use of capital? British American Tobacco, if I'm a shareholder, took $100 million or $130 million and invested it into Organigram. So we don't know what we're doing in cannabis. We're going to go put $130 million in cash in a company that clearly has no idea what it's doing in cannabis. So bad move. It's a bad move. And then you're effectively using it as kind of a fund to go and make investments in other companies. So if I don't know what I'm doing, big, dumb corporate pile of money, please call me. Anyone who needs to figure out, please call me. Please call me. And then I'm going to go put a lot of shareholder money into what I perceive is kind of, and I don't want to diss Organigram, but isn't like the bellwether of companies in cannabis. And then they're going to go do what Henry and Adam does, which is make investments out of it. That's a bad use of capital going into a bad use of company for a reason, even a worse use of capital. Clear?
Thank you, Seth. Yeah, that's clear and concise and sweet. Thanks.
I'll tell you who I think has a huge opportunity is Sundial. They're sitting on a ton of money. They've got several redemptions. Please call me. You could drive.
Okay.
You could drive a semi truck through half of the industry, and you could literally, like, you know, be the invention of fire. Like, that's how critical you need that much money in cannabis right now. So I think that there's the opportunity for
1-800 Seth Yakutan.
Yeah. Yeah. Make sure you send the wire transfer first, but it's okay. I'm kidding. I'm on one today, guys. I'm on one.
Pato, I have one tiny follow up from the chat. There's a lot of conversation that's been going on in terms of capital flow. If companies are able to deduct taxes, and, you know, in terms of if rescheduling happens, these are questions that, you know, people are asking in the chat. What about that flow of money? Is that something that will likely happen? And then if rescheduling 3 will be sort of like opening a gate for CBD pharma companies, but sort of like Seth, you touched a little bit on that, but I want to hear from Adam and Henry too. Cash flow.
Sure. So I think via rescheduling, you know, every business will have to consult with their tax professionals on sort of optimal tax structure. But one of the things that will become available that's not today, given that 280E is taxed on gross profit, is that businesses will be able to deduct their interest expense. So if a business is utilizing debt, there's often an optimal amount of debt where not only from avoiding equity dilution, but you're able to use that interest expense as a tax mitigant or tax blocker to reduce the tax expense at the end of the year. And that's something that doesn't exist in the current 280E climate.
Which also serves to reduce your overall rate. I mean, in essence, if you're borrowing at X, but you're able to write off a portion of that, you know, in essence, you could view that as a reduction of the rate you're paying. But I already spoke to the fact that I think it'll lead to more cash flow. And I think that leads to more opportunity, both in terms of your ability to borrow, but just in terms of how you deploy that money for growth rather than for reserve for taxes, which the current structure is insane. So I think that answers that. There was another question you mentioned in there, I think, about CBD, which is, I think, separate and distinct. Now, the only thing I'll say there is some unknown. And is there, you know, what's going to happen with a rewrite of a farm bill and, you know, current hemp being converted to intoxicating hemp was clearly not the intent of the farm bill. Now, I am not anti-intoxicating hemp. I just think that there's a loophole here where you've got an overly oppressive structure for THC, and you have kind of the Wild West for intoxicating hemp. And I think there just needs to be a bit more parity. I think there is absolutely room for all of it, and all of it should be in a position to thrive. It also needs to be safe, and we need to avoid issues so that we don't end up running into, like, the example that all the anti-cannabis politicians grab onto and use against this industry. So I think that in an ideal scenario, intoxicating hemp remains, but maybe with a bit more regulation. It's certainly we know the regulatory environment is too restrictive and oppressive in its current form for cannabis. So what can we do to meet in the middle? But something will likely change. But in the interim, we service hemp just as we service THC.
Thank you, gentlemen, for shedding light on this.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to, I mean, I think this sets up the landscape pretty well for our next question, our next topic, which is more oriented to the future. So I actually wanted to start with Henry on this. I would like to hear your thoughts on the emerging trends that are currently shaping the cannabis finance sector. So Henry, are there any new types of financial instruments you expect to become more prevalent, or how are you seeing the market right now?
I don't know that I would say it's any new instruments that become more prevalent. Obviously, we spent a lot of time talking about how 280E will affect financials. I do think that the next, call it 5 years in cannabis, will be an opportunity for operators that show that they can produce profitably and win as markets become more competitive to acquire and grow their businesses via M&A activity that will start to pick up. So I do think we will see a wave of that over the next, call it 3 to 5 years. As Seth touched on, you know, industries tend to consolidate over time. And I don't think cannabis will be different, especially as legislation changes and more money starts to pour into the market.
Thank you very much. Adam, Seth, do you have any take on this?
I will say I think there will continue to be an evolution of financial products that constantly are iterated by those that deploy them. So, for example, the way FunCanna operates today is different than the way it operated 2.5 years ago. We offer different types of products, and by that I mean variety, not just evolution. And we're continuing to listen to the market and to look at the landscape and make sure that the product we offer not only matches the need, but matches capacity. And so I think that will not change. And in any environment, especially in a healthy environment, and I think we're not necessarily in that environment yet, but as we become a healthier industry, and by that I just mean evolution of law, I think the products will continue to iterate. There isn't anything where we're like right on, other than Henry's point, we've all kind of beaten to death this 280E piece. But other than freeing up some cash flow and seeking clarity there, I don't think there's going to be a mad rush. I know one of the comments made reference to the fact that if 280E goes away, defaults will go down. And I think in a responsible underwriting environment, that shouldn't be the case. And the reason I say that is if you're underwriting for current cash flow and then cash flow evolves to accommodate 280E, you would evolve your underwriting the same way, in theory anyway, and hopefully in close to practice. You shouldn't really see any kind of like precipitous drop in your defaults. If you underwrite responsibly now and you underwrite responsibly post rescheduling, things should be the same. You should just be able to deploy more money, not necessarily with less risk.
Very interesting. And Seth, you said you come from the pharmaceutical sector. So are there any lessons that can be learned from other industries that might affect the future of financial trends in cannabis?
Well, I mean, the question was around future financial trends, right? So can I go back and answer that question too?
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead, please.
I think one thing that you're going to see is that nincompoopery is going to continue to be tolerated, maybe not rewarded. So I can think of four public companies that, giving their impending debt maturities, and I've spoken about it very publicly, should probably not exist. And there's not a forcing function for that in cannabis like there is in other industries to create market efficiency. So I think if there is someone who raises a large enough pile of capital that's new to create a forcing function in the industry, that could be very interesting. Something which I've seen privately, and I haven't seen it broadcast publicly yet, is that there's rumor of a historical SPAC operator in the cannabis industry who's out trying to raise another SPAC, which if that SPAC gets raised, I think will annoy me on the level of, you know, someone who's like a lifetime Yankees fan watching the Red Sox win the World Series. I don't think that, you know, there's so many great places for capital to be deployed in cannabis. You know, if that piece of paper clears, it just basically tells me that the world investment client is not open to really the great opportunity. On the pharmaceutical side, I think what you're going to see, and I think if we take a lesson from there, you know, most large pharmaceutical companies have become acquirers of smaller, more innovative companies that do things that they can't do. And I believe that trend is going to come in cannabis at some point. And I believe there's going to be some catalyst for it. And if there's, you know, one lesson that I take from pharma is that, you know, the GTIs and the Veranos and the Curaleaves and the TerraSens of the world are either going to have to acquire innovation and cash flow, or they're going to have to be acquired. And if you look at J&J and Pfizer and GSK and Novartis, that's how they've grown. And I think you're going to see that model deployed out, hopefully in the next decade in cannabis. And that's, you know, what I'm hoping for. So.
Super insightful answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. So I have, you know, we thought about folks when we were, you know, so like coming up with the webinar, we thought about the folks looking at or watching and watching this later on YouTube, which you can always go and check, like, subscribe, save. And I have a few follow-up questions more on each one of yours, let's say business model, your offer. I want to go ahead and start by you, Henry. I wanted to ask you about let me check my notes because I want to be clear. I want to quote you, right? Value-added construction lending strategy. So I know there's a couple strategies there in terms of lending for real estate. I wanted to talk about value-add construction lending strategy, stabilized lending strategy. What are these strategies? If you can tell us a little bit about for our entrepreneurs out there.
Sure. So as a mortgage REIT, Polaris is a lender to real estate, specifically to the cannabis industry. And we focus on either value add or construction lending or lending to stabilized real estate assets. And a value add or construction loan will be either a refurbished or built to spec cannabis production facility. Most often we will look at obviously retail and other sites as well. One of the things that's unique to cannabis is that the easy thing is to say these are industrial buildings or they're greenhouses, but the reality is they're very specialized pieces of real estate. I guess a comparable might be like a data center that is housed in an industrial building, but the equipment that's inside is very specialized to the industry and also carries a significant cost. So we will look at the full project scope when we're evaluating a value add or construction loan, both what the cost is, what goes into it, and then what's that market value upon completion. For a stabilized loan, we're looking at the same real estate, but we want to see that it's been fully completed. And when we look at it as a stabilized deal, not only are we looking for real estate completion, but we also want to see that the operating business is stabilized and cash flowing at a level that is going to meet our underwriting requirements.
Excellent. That's a great set. You're going to say something? I saw you taking breath there. I saw you were going to add. Okay. So yeah, that's great to have an idea of what's the palette out there of options in terms of expanding operations. Adam, I've been also stalking your website and going through the company and seeing what you have there. And I see that you offer something that is, you know, as a cultivator, it's one of the things that you're always, you know, crunching numbers and seeing how you're going to make to ends meet. That's capital for working capital and, you know, investment to make your business more efficient. And that's very important, especially in cannabis. Forget about it. If you're doing it indoors, you need air filters. You need, you know, from water solution. You need all these kinds, all this stuff that actually help you be more efficient and you know, ensure the cash flow and all the things that are so important that we've been discussing so far. So can you tell us a story of success of folks who said, who came to you and said, hey, Adam, look, we know, or we have shown, we can show you that if we buy this piece of equipment, we're going to make this flower more resinous. It's going to be, you know, a higher price in the market or whatever. And that actually worked. So can you tell us a little bit about these best practices and the solutions that you offer?
So I can give two examples, because this was for anyone that's watching this live or later. This was not planned. So I want to make sure that the audience realizes I don't have that example queued up. But I can give two examples that are slight variations on your theme. One is a crude oil manufacturer, and the other is a vertically integrated cultivator and retailer. In the manufacturer, the way that was used was they have to take orders. And then the way our funding would fit in, they take orders, they pay cash. So for a manufacturer of crude oil, he's buying biomass, he's buying flour. He has to buy that. Let's say he buys $500,000 worth of flour to manufacture oil. It takes him 4 months to do that. And so he's got a lab test, he's got to do all of this, and then he delivers the product on the order, and then he gets paid. But that money was parked for 4 months. And all the while, additional orders that come in, he's locked up because he's got his money in this biomass in his manufacturing process. So even if he's given terms, those terms are 30 days, his cycle is 4 months. So we started funding his purchases of biomass. And then as revenue would come in, he would pay us down. And then he would draw again, revolving that cycle. Now, he ended up borrowing from us 22 times. He was borrowing in various stages, but ultimately his business grew 350% because he was able to borrow to fund his growth. And then on the vertically integrated side, there was pretty large company, a multi-state operator, but their CFO came to us to say, hey, we have square footage, but it's not built out, doesn't have lights, doesn't have HVAC. We want to build more grow rooms. And so we funded the construction for further build out of a facility that also ended up leading to more outdoor grow greenhouses outside of his indoor grow facility. They went from negative $6 million on an EBITDA basis to break even to now plus $9 million EBITDA. And it was really using our money to fuel the growth. And now they continue to use us for nutrients. So they're buying all of their nutrients using our capital. And then as all those grow rooms, they're all obviously staged and stacked. As revenue comes in, they pay down and start over. We pay the nutrient suppliers direct. They don't even have to deal with the bill. And then they pay us down over a period of time, and they control the cost because they can pay us anytime they want and pay only for time used. So we've worked that way with all segments, both ancillary and supply chain. And that's, I would say, the most common way, two examples of the most common way that our capital
gets deployed. Yeah. Very clear. Seth, I love your Vader's voice back there. You know, I know you from work, and there's something that Pato pointed out earlier today, and that's so like the humane, soft, whatever you want to call it, part of deal making and matchmaking. And finding people with needs and finding people with solutions and connecting these two, so like different ways to make to achieve something or to, you know, create a business. So I was wondering, in the process of connecting folks and matchmaking, are there any, because sometimes, you know, when folks looking for financing might address this and be like, oh, you know, it's a complicated process. I'm not really savvy. You know, I'm a cultivator or I'm an extractor or, you know, whatever your part is in the supply chain. I'm not really a finance guy. So is there any advice that you provide through this process? Is it always tough love that they come to you and you're like, bad breath, out of here? Or is it like, you got bad breath, but let me give you this, you know, wash or whatever you use for against bad breath. But, you know, so like there's any comeback for certain businesses, or is it because I bet that not everything is so black and white, right? Sometimes you have to so like build out the relationship and you're like, there's some trouble with you, but I'll help you get there. Is that something that happens?
Look, absolutely. You know, look, people hire me to help them raise money and buy and sell assets. Like, that's what I do. When you are getting hundreds of inbound things to review and I don't have, you know, the weaponization of a fund like Fundcana or Polaris, you know, it's very easy to kind of be dismissive and just say, you know, no to a lot of things harshly. I don't think there's enough honesty. I think the reason that people tend to work with me is that I'm honest and I keep my mouth shut. So, you know, if I take something on, there's usually kind of three factors that I look at before I just say you have bad breath, or I say you have bad breath and I can help you. You know, normally it's kind of, okay, what do you want to go and do? What do you think it's worth? So how much money you want to raise? What do you think the valuation of your company is, or how much you want to pay for it? And what's the market look like, right? And if there's not an intersection of those three things, I don't care how good I am. I don't have, you know, magic beans. I know what getting money from Henry looks like in terms of its cost of capital. I know the kind of things that he wants to do. I know what getting money from Adam looks like and what the cost of capital is and the kind of things that he wants to do. If you have something that doesn't fit for models, doesn't matter, you know, if it doesn't matter how good I am, or is my internet going out here?
Now we can hear you. The image just, it's a little bit choppy, but we can hear you fine.
Yeah. We have some questions on the chat. Thank you, Seth. We got you perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is really an amazing conversation. We are receiving a lot of, devs questions in the chat. There's a lot of people watching. So if you agree, gentlemen, I think we can jump to the chat questions. And I would like to start with one. I think we can display that question on screen. Let me just 1 second here. Because the first one is about, like, it's modeling from Seth, what Seth said earlier about...
There's three that are really hard. Yeah.
Oh, okay, there it is.
I got it. What sort of models do I think don't work? Just a brand, just taking your brand and putting across a couple different form factors in a state that's already deeply penetrated like California. Like, if I want to have the Seth brand tomorrow and I don't have, you know, cultivation, or I don't have extraction, or I don't have some other level of infrastructure, or I don't have retail, exceptionally hard. So, you know, if someone comes to me and says, well, I have a great idea for a brand in California, and that's it, it's not going to happen. If I see another deal for someone who wants to build a humongous greenhouse in New Jersey, it's not going to happen. So don't come to me with a greenhouse in New Jersey. We don't need more cultivation in New Jersey. You don't need 1 million square feet of cultivation in New Jersey. And you don't need a greenhouse in New Jersey. So when you have something in a state where you just know the supply and demand economics of what exists, what's already built, what's in process, and where it's going,
that's a model that's not going to work. That's very clearly kind of a no. Another thing, if you just have a retail license, you need to listen to me. I don't care what you think it's worth. It's worth 50% of what you think it's worth if you've never been in retail before and you've never been in cannabis before. So I can tell you, in every state that I go to, I meet someone that says, boy, gosh darn it, I just got lucky and I got this license and I think it's worth $17 million. It's not a lottery ticket. So those are three very distinct models that I see a lot. That, and I'm not going to say you're not going to make it. Maybe you will make it. I hope you make it. Please prove me wrong. But when I just look at empirical data, your probability of raising money is single digits and your probability of success is single digits. Now, that was the probability of putting human space travel on the moon. So maybe I'm incorrect, but those are three models that clearly aren't going to be highly successful in raising money.
Thank you, Seth. Henry, Adam, do you have any comments on this?
The only thing I'll say is the data that I've got access, aside from, you know, the headsets, the BDSAs, et cetera, and the MJ Biz fact book, right? The data that I've got access to is our data. And so on the roughly 3,000 or so applicants by vertical, and what I can say is there is a big difference by geography and vertical in terms of performance. Once they're on our book, there's a big difference in terms of predictors and cash flow as we underwrite. But because we're different than Seth, if I'm talking to, let's just to stick with his example, a guy that is running a cultivator in New Jersey, we're looking at his financials before we give him capital. So where Seth may be looking at the prospect or the idea of building that out, we're only looking at the guy that's already doing it. And so we just come from a different place. And so I think Seth has actually a better view than I on the areas that at their state or stage of infancy, what has a greater chance of success, where I can tell you once already operating, I can see where the stability lies, both by geography and segment of the industry.
Very clear. Thank you for that. Henry, any thoughts on this question?
Not much specific to add, just back to the focus on markets. Look at where the state you operate in is in its life cycle and who would you be competing against. And when you're online, what percentage of that market share do you need to take? If you've underwritten to something where you need to grab 25% of a market, that's going to be very challenging to do. So it's not specific to one vertical necessarily. It's just look at the fundamentals of your state and look at who's online or coming online.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good comment. Yep. So I think we can jump to the next one. I think there's someone asking about tips. Let me see if I can bring up the question. Okay. Tips for pre-revenue startup with founders who have proven track record of sales in the MI market. Do you see the question on screen, right? Again, we can take it or not. It's just your call.
How much truth?
Go ahead, Seth.
How much truth do you want to hear? Like, pre-revenue startup with founders who have a proven record of sales. That's awesome. Like, go call grandma, get $500,000 and start the company. It's just going to be very hard to raise money for that thing. Bootstrap it. Like, my suggestion is bootstrap it.
Yeah, that's the optimistic answer. Bootstrap and prove to investors you don't already know that you're investable by showing them results.
Agreed.
Thank you very much. And I think we have another one here. There's also a lot of doubt, for state-specific situations. I don't think we'll have a lot of time to address that, but I'd love to ask our audience to also drop those questions in the chat, so maybe we can address that on the comments later after the live show. But let me see if we have any other question. Okay, there we go. What are your views on opportunities outside the US, like, for example, the United Kingdom, Germany, broader Europe, etc.?
I think that if you ask me in my lifetime, the opportunity is massive. I think if I were trying to throw the dart at the board, I'm wearing a blindfold as to when that happens. But I will say that, again, back to data, if you look at Germany, the amount of people that either live within Germany or directly border it is roughly 70 or 75% of the population of the US. So I think that the general trend is, as Germany develops and evolves and where their legislation lands, I think much of the EU will follow. And then from there, you'll see more internationally, because there's many existing trade agreements that exist between EU and nations outside of the EU.
Interesting. Okay, if there are no more comments on this one, maybe we can jump to the next one. Seth?
Go ahead, Seth.
I was just going to say, you know, European markets are really hard for me to understand from a commercialization perspective. I have tended to focus on Australia, and I'm involved in the largest MS, the largest operator there, which is a company called Canatrek. And I think that's going to be a phenomenal market. It's just been much easier for me to get my hands around. I do think that the EU and specifically Germany will be good markets. I just don't know how to interface there from an investor or operational perspective. It's just, I'm too far removed.
Right.
And I'll just say, we're looking at all four other regions, Canada, Europe, Latin America, and Australia. The only reason we may start with Canada, for just the reason that we have a partnership opportunity, and it's the easiest in terms of setup. But you know, you enter every new market with a lot of caution, and we'll do that as well. But I don't have a great answer for the individual that asked the question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I just want to say that rescheduling of cannabis also creates an important precedent for other countries. I'm thinking on the Thai example in Thailand, which recently went back on its feet. And again, as the US being the main sponsor of prohibition and now going backwards, now again, it might create, rescheduling might also create a new wave of policy around the world. So also, yeah, it's absolutely something to guess on the future, but hopefully this creates again a good precedent. Let me see if our producer can throw in another question, and I think we can wrap up this conversation. And this has been like a hurricane of insights and very detailed information.
Yeah, a lot of homework. To go back, I bet that, we got one from Gregory.
I actually, I'm going to jump on this one. I actually made reference to this earlier, Gregory. I saw the question fly by as we were talking. And what I'd say is there's no doubt more choice in any market as it matures, more choices evolve. And so I think that will be the case here, too. I don't know. This is a vice industry, like alcohol, like tobacco, like so many others, right? Firearms, pornography, et cetera. And so I don't know how quickly others are going to come rushing in, because on a relative basis, the legal industry is still pretty small. Now, having said that, if regulation changes, there's a lot of opportunity for us to grow, you know, beyond the projected 35 or so billion annually. But I go back to my answer, Gregory, earlier regarding the lowered default rates. I think that effective risk management and credit policy should dictate not a precise outcome, but a range of outcomes. And I think that'll be the case as the any landscape evolves, if you're good at what you do, and again, I'm not implying that I'm speaking about Fundcana here, but if you're good at what you do, you evolve with the times. And so as regulation evolves, your policy internally should evolve. And that might mean that you get looser. It might mean that you get tighter. And for that reason, I don't necessarily expect lower default rates, but I do expect more choice. And I hope, although it's two different answers, I hope it answers the question you're asking. Yeah, just my take. I open it back to Henry and Seth.
No, I mean, I didn't get a chance to chime in on that question, but I think that Gregory, if that's who's asked the question, is kind of correct. I mean, let's make the assumption that Schedule 3 happens, and let's make the assumption that 280E goes away. Depending upon what you believe, there's somewhere between $2 and $3.5 billion of cash that's now being paid to the government that's not going to be paid to the government. And I think that, you know, the 15 or 50 largest companies in the industry are probably going to benefit the most from that. So if you're Curaleaf, Trulieve, GTI, Verano, and you have an extra $150 million of cash in your balance sheet, you're probably going to pay off debt. Like, that's probably the prudent corporate finance thing to do. So I do think that what will happen is you'll have some level of delevering. I do think you'll have, I hope, a slightly lower of cost of capital for people. I do think you will see a proliferation of the zombies. Some of the companies that should be dead will get another breath of life. I don't know that a bunch of private equity companies are going to come in as a result of that, because they're still federally not allowed to. But I do think that, you know, you'll see this kind of spiral if those events happen. I also don't think that default rates are necessarily going to be any lower, at least not for certain types of credits. That's for sure.
Thank you very much. Henry, any thoughts on this question?
I would agree with what Seth said about the default rates, and we've touched on throughout the conversation. I think in general, cannabis capital markets will open up as 280E is lifted, not specifically just debt. If anything, I think that cannabis debt's been more influenced by the rate cycle over the last 2 years. And we've seen them become less crowded as rates have gone up elsewhere and capital has left to be redeployed in other asset classes outside of cannabis. So if anything, as capital comes in, I think it will flow to the specialized groups that know the marketplace. And that's not to say that there won't be new entrants, as there are in any industry, but I think debt specifically has seen more impact from the rate cycle. But I do think that capital markets will open up as 280 is lifted, and that will be a benefit for existing investors and also operators, just the industry at large.
Thank you very much. And well, Adam, Seth, Henry, this is been a really, really insightful discussion. We are really grateful for your time, and I just wanted to leave you some space for any final thoughts or closing remarks you want to add. Want to go ahead, Adam?
Sure. I would encourage anyone that's curious about what we do to call in and speak with someone at Fundcana. We don't charge for conversations, and our job is to be consultative. So if you've got questions, my suggestion is please reach out and ask them. And I see our URL is up. Thank you for that. Feel free to visit the website. But I always think that interaction with another person is beneficial. So they're really, I encourage, I'm a lifelong learner. I always say never a professor, always a student. And so if you've got questions, it can't hurt to get someone's perspective, knowing that there's no obligation. So please call in.
Lovely. Seth?
You know, I would just say anybody who wants to get a hold of me, I have a very small social media presence on LinkedIn, so you can DM me there.
Very
subtle. And you can send me an email to my email address, and happy to be helpful. Please don't be offended if I can't help you.
The most valuable, precious commodity I have left is time, and I'm trying to spend it on things that I know I can get done. So, you know, I do say no. And when I do say no, I mean no. But, you know, look, I think I have an ongoing dialogue with about 100 people a week in the industry, and it's usually about 50 CEOs of companies and about 25 people, you know, like, you know, Henry and Adam and 25 other, you know, bankers and service providers. So I think I have a very good understanding of what's possible. And if you have an operational company and you know, you want to understand what's possible, please call me and I'm happy to, you know, tell you what I think. But bullish on the sector, I'm not going anywhere unless they put a bullet and it grazes my ear. So.
Thank you, Seth. Henry, who are you?
Not much to add. Thank you for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to speak. And if anybody wants to reach out, phone and email are open at Polaris Capital Group to discuss cannabis real estate financing.
Awesome. Thank you very much. So, Nico, before we close live, any thoughts for you? All right.
What was that? Sorry, I didn't get that.
I said thank you. I said thank you to Benzinga and Cannabis Insider and my co-panelists for the platform and for the opportunity. Grateful. Can't believe anyone would ever want to spend an hour and 31 minutes listening to me talk. So grateful for the opportunity to be here.
Oh, we have a lot of people watching us live until now. So I guess you must have said some interesting stuff here. And okay, this was our first Cannabis B2B webinar. We're very happy for having hosted this. Again, gentlemen, thank you very, very much for your insights and your time. And for everyone watching this live right now or in the future, please subscribe, follow us on our social media, like, share, save the video, everything you know. And of course, meet us at the Benzinga Capital Conference in Chicago in October. So stay green, stay informed. Until next time, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.